the effort to go after lawmakers, records of the press, this is just one subset of the broader problem of justice over the last 4 years.
Over the last 4 years, Congressman Schiff, how about the last 20? Just saying.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's one reason.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Here I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN and Eureka's KGOE, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO and Eugene's KEPW, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, also in Concord, New Hampshire on WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, in Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day, reliably so, on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, and Detour Talk, Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me. From bradblog.com, thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. So thrilling, in fact, that our own producer, Desi Doyen, has no idea what we're going to be covering. Is that correct, Desi Doyen?
Yes, that is correct. You told me there's something that came in, yes, but you would not tell me what it was.
Correct. I think it's best you don't know these things in advance. So, yeah, most of the media, of course, we had planned on covering what really most of the media is covering today, rather frantically, by the way, the Joe Biden-Vladimir Putin summit on Wednesday morning in Geneva, Switzerland. And if time allows, and I don't know if it will or not at this point, because I also have a guest I need to get to, that I want to get to. But if time allows, I'll try to hit that a bit as well, because I had a few thoughts on it to share today. We'll see if I have time, though I do know I take some comfort in knowing that everyone else will be covering that to death today if I can't get to it, albeit not with my precision insight and clever, I don't know.
Assessment and analysis, yes.
Right. But, I've also, as I said, got a guest coming up momentarily that I do need to get to, that I want to get to. So time is shorter than I might like today, as is the case pretty much every day these days, it seems. But listen, I saw this story within the past hour, and I've just had to sort of throw everything else out, Des.
Okay.
My apologies. So I threw everything out for this, which we'll see if you agree, is very encouraging news late today coming from NBC.
Well, I'm always in favor of encouraging news.
Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, opened the door to a compromise on voting legislation Wednesday with a memo outlining provisions of federal voting and campaign finance legislation that he would support. Huh. This, of course, is very, very good news, at least in my opinion. As you know, Joe Manchin has emerged as a key figure, really the key figure.
The linchpin.
Yes, in the Democratic Party's fight to pass federal legislation aimed at protecting voting rights, as GOP lawmakers at the state level are furiously passing new bills to suppress those voting rights and, by the way, to allow Republicans to change election results that they simply do not like for virtually any reason that they want. Now, none of the Democratic proposals to date deal with that aspect of what the Republicans are doing, neither the Sweeping for the People Act, also known as H.R. 1 in the House, which has already passed it there, and S1 in the Senate, where it is co-sponsored by all of the Democratic senators, save for Joe Manchin, who said he opposed the For the People Act a week or two ago. So that doesn't deal with the concern about Republicans just overturning election results on a whim, nor does the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which revives the central element of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which the Supreme Court gutted in 2013, and which Joe Manchin has said previously that he would support. He would support that one. None of those proposals currently counters that pretty scary element of the Republican bills at the state level, where state Republican lawmakers are allowing for these results to simply be changed on a whim. But both the For the People Act and the John Lewis Act would go a very long way toward countering many of the voter suppression tactics that are being enacted by Republicans in state after state after state at the state level, and that need to be answered to ASAP in some fashion before the 2022 midterms. Yet, both the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, for now, are being held up. For the People has passed the House, but the conservative West Virginia Democrat, Joe Manchin, says he does not support it in the Senate, despite all 49 of his colleagues in the Democratic caucus doing so. And in the meantime, the John Lewis Act is going to be held up. It needs to develop a legislative record over in the House so that when it is inevitably challenged by Republicans in the courts, they'll be able to show that there was, in fact, a need for this legislation. So that's going to take a while in any event.
Because they have to go through committees in order to develop that legislative record to show the Supreme Court.
Right. And in any event, that's the one that Joe Biden said, that Joe Manchin says he would support instead of the For the People Act. It's not really an either or. They each do different things. But he said he would support that, and that he expects Republicans will join him in that. Well, so far, he's actually been able to sign up exactly one Republican. That would be Lisa Murkowski of Alaska on the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. But it would take 10 Republicans to overturn to defeat a filibuster in order to pass that, even if it does make it out of the House and eventually into the Senate. In the meantime, the For the People Act is just sitting there, has all kinds of provisions in it that would counter many, if not all, of the provisions of these Republican bills that are going through state houses around the country. And so on Wednesday, Joe Manchin reaffirmed to reporters, according to NBC, that he still believes voting legislation, including his own proposed version, this compromise that he put forward today, he believes it should be passed on a bipartisan basis. He doesn't back amending the filibuster rules to pass it without Republican support. So even if this compromise he's offering is accepted by his party, there's still the matter of how to get it passed without reforming the filibuster, which Joe Manchin opposes. But hey, one thing at a time, please. So Manchin has proposed this compromise to the For the People Act. He also has some stuff for the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. But most notably on For the People, which he says he would support with these compromises, because a week or two ago he said he does not support the For the People Act. So while I certainly do not speak for Senate or House Democrats, I'm here to say, great, I'll take your compromise, Senator Manchin. Let's pass it. Let's pass it today. So here is what he's calling for. Here's this memo, and we'll post this at bradblog.com, of course, when we post today's show. He says, voting legislation. The right to vote is fundamental to our American democracy, and protecting that right should not be about party or politics. Well, true, shouldn't be, but anyway. Back to reality. He writes, congressional action on federal voting rights legislation must be the result of both Democrats and Republicans coming together to find a pathway forward, or we risk further dividing and destroying the republic we swore to protect and defend as elected officials. Okay. That ignores the fact that Republicans are doing no such thing at the state level, but never mind that. He says, below are areas of support and additions for federal voting legislation and updates to the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. So here is what he proposes as his compromise for the For the People Act. And a number of these things are new that he is adding, I guess that he is requesting that haven't been in here before. Other things, I guess, are things that he is saying he supports, that he would support if it was in the bill. Presumably, this means you have to throw everything else out, but that's okay. There's actually a ton in that For the People Act. Most of it good, some of it not great. But if it means we can get any of this passed, I say we take it. Okay, here's his list. Number one, make Election Day a public holiday. That's new, he says. I guess that it wasn't in the For the People Act. And I'm fine with it. Make Election Day a public holiday. If that makes Joe Manchin happy, I'm okay with that. Two, mandate at least 15 consecutive days of early voting for federal elections, including two weekends. I believe that's already in the For the People Act. But this signals that Joe Manchin supports that. That's good, because that's a good thing. Three, ban partisan gerrymandering and use computer models. Now, I'm not sure exactly what that means. We'll need some more details on that. The current For the People Act does ban partisan gerrymandering in that it allows for independent committees, independent commissions to develop the redistricting maps for individual states when it comes to Congress. As far as use computer models, I'm not sure what that means. But that includes a notice here that that is new, some new idea of his to use computer models. Okay, fine. As long as it bans partisan gerrymandering, I'll accept that.
And as long as the computer models help to ban that partisan gerrymandering.
Well, presumably, but we do know that the computer models that Republicans use right now do the exact opposite. They
True.
Gerrymander the hell out of these states. So, okay, sounds good. Number four, require voter ID.
Mm.
Yeah, I know. With allowable alternatives like utility bills, etc. Now that etc. may be doing a lot of work there in that parenthetical, but he says allowable alternatives, utility bills, etc. to prove identity to vote. He calls that new. Because I don't believe there had been anything about requiring voter ID in the Democratic proposal. So here's the thing. With allowable alternatives, the devil will be in the details here as far as what those alternatives are. He suggests one being utility bills. Right now, a majority of the states in the country already have some form of voter ID requirement at the polling place. Voter ID requirements in and of themselves are not a problem. And by the way, take it from the guy who has been, I think, yelling just about as loud or as long as anyone in this nation about concerns about the photo ID restrictions that Republicans had been putting through. I had to get the attention of Congress early on about what was going on with this. I remember when I had to get John Conyers, who finally was one of the few who came on board in the House to say, yeah, this is a problem.
That's to be clear, though, that you're talking about the difference between requiring a photo ID versus another kind of alternate ID.
The problem is the very strict, not just any photo ID, but very strict, a very few types of allowable photo IDs. For example, a gun license may be allowed, but a student ID with a photograph from a state-run university is not allowed in many of these states. So those are the ones I have a problem with, those that are meant to prevent people from voting. But the majority of states already have some form of voter ID requirement that would allow, if you don't have a driver's license, you could bring in a utility bill, a bank statement, a pay stub from where you work, etc. And it sounds like that's what Joe Manchin is talking about here. That would probably be the most controversial of his proposals here among Democrats. But again, devil is in the details. I think this could be worked with. If it gets us all of this other stuff, I think it's something we should look at very closely. Number five, automatic registration through the DMV with the option to opt out. That's good. That's already in there. He supports it. Sounds good to me. Six, require states to promote access to voter registration and voting for persons with disability and older individuals. Cool. No problem. Seven, prohibit providing false information about elections to hinder or discourage voting and increases penalties for voter intimidation. Excellent. That's already in there. He supports that. I'll take it. Require states to, this is another new one, require states to send absentee ballots, to send absentee by mail ballots to eligible voters before an election, if voter is not able to vote in person during early voting or election day due to eligible circumstance, and allow civic penalty for failure. He says that is new. It's a little bit confusing, but it sounds to me like it would not mandate no excuse absentee voting in every single state. But it would require an absentee ballot to be sent to the voters if they're not going to be available or they're not able to make it during election day or during early voting. And it puts in a fine, a civil penalty for failure to meet this one. That could be controversial, but again, it's a matter of measuring it against all of these other things. Because right now, there's a whole bunch of states that good luck getting an absentee vote by mail ballot in Texas under almost any circumstances.
Correct.
Number nine, require the Elections Assistance Commission to develop model training programs and award grants for training. Yeah, don't know what that means. Sounds fine to me. Require states to notify an individual not later than 7 days before election if his or her polling place has changed. That's good. That's already in the bill. It's something Joe Manchin supports. Great. Thank you for letting us know, Senator. Absentee ballots shall be carried expeditiously and free of postage. Also good. All supported in the For the People Act as is. Allow for maintenance of voter rolls by utilizing information derived from state and federal documents. Establish standards for election vendors based on cybersecurity concerns. Allow provisional ballots to count for all eligible races, regardless of the precinct one votes in. So those are the main points that he describes as Voting Legislation for the People Act compromise. That bill for the people also includes stuff on campaign finance and ethics. He does say there are a number of things he would support there as well. Hopefully working towards getting rid of dark money in our elections. He calls for amending the Federal Election Campaign Act to create a reporting requirement for disclosing reportable foreign contacts. He supports the Disclose Act, the Honest Ads Act, and to create coordinated spender category, whatever that means, to ensure single candidate super PACs do not operate as arms of campaigns, all of which sounds to me like it adds transparency to the process. If that's what it takes, if this is what he would support, I say, again, I don't speak for the House or Senate Democrats, but I say Democrats need to jump on this ASAP, write it up, get it into legislative form, get it into the Senate, get it passed, get it over in the House, get it passed. Take what you can get, senators. Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia said he is hopeful, based on this information, this new compromise, that we will find a way forward. He says, we've got to find a way to get voting rights, period. Is there room for compromise and conversation? Absolutely, he says. Another Democratic aide involved in the negotiations on S1 in the Senate says progress is progress, and understanding what Senator Manchin's concerns are about the bill is helpful in moving forward. This is a very optimistic moment, he says, or she says, in the trajectory of ensuring expanded voting rights. This is the best news I've heard in weeks, Desi Doyen. We now know it's certainly imperfect because, you know, it's Joe Manchin. But hey, It includes a way forward and a way to pass a lot of much needed stuff, at least to get the support of 50 Democrats in the Senate. However, to get any of that passed, you're still going to need to get Joe Manchin on board to do away with the filibuster, because there ain't no Republicans coming on, even with that voter ID mandate.
Oh, indeed. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is pretty much disinterested in giving Biden any legislative victories at all.
And this is something that Manchin's going to have to figure out. But as I say, a path is laid one stone at a time.
True.
At least Joe Manchin is coming out and saying, yes, here's something I could compromise on. Here's what I support. Here's what I don't. Now we have something to work with. Let's see if we can. In the meantime, over in the U.S. House, Democrats are hopping mad after learning that the Trump Department of Justice had, in the Democrats' words, spied on members of Congress by secretly subpoenaing the phone, email, and text records of Congressman Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell back in 2018, and they are right to be outraged about it. But as my guest joining me momentarily, Marcy Wheeler of Empty Wheel, points out this week, after the stunning news broke, some perspective may be in order here on this story as well. Marcy is here to bring that perspective next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Yeah, the House is a-rockin' right now. They are mad. They are really mad over there in the U.S. House of Representatives. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Yes, they are really mad. One of their own was, as they say, spied on. Two of their own, actually, both Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell, both from California and both members of the U.S. House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Schiff is the chair, though he was only its ranking Democratic member back in 2018, when the Trump administration's Department of Justice, as we recently learned, secretly subpoenaed Apple for both Schiff and Swalwell's telephone, email, and text message records. It was, as they say, only metadata. In other words, the records of those calls, emails, and text messages, just the records that they happened, the fact that they happened, and who they went to and or were received from, if not the actual content of that of those messages, at least as far as we are told. The DOJ also issued a gag order at the time on Apple to prevent them from telling Schiff or Swalwell or any of the other several scores of congressional aides and even their children, one of whom was a minor, that any of this was happening, that the Department of Justice was examining who the two Democratic lawmakers and their staff and their children were in contact with amid an investigation by the Trump administration into a leak of classified material. The attempt by the executive branch under Trump to secretly subpoena records from lawmakers, members of the legislative branch, is, as far as anyone seems to know, unprecedented, at least in a leak investigation, as opposed to a criminal corruption probe. And this clear, seemingly clear violation of the constitutional separation of powers between the executive and legislative branches, the actual seemingly lawful surveillance of members of Congress by an executive branch agency, this happened at pretty much the very same time that the Trump administration was blocking largely any and all lawful congressional subpoenas for documents and testimonies from them, from members of executive branch agencies, under the premise, as they argued hypocritically enough at the time, well, that would be an outrageous violation of the Constitution's separation of powers clause. This week, just days after the fairly gobsmacking news that was broken by the New York Times, the U.S. House Judiciary Committee, now headed up by Democrats, announced that they were going to open a formal investigation into the Trump DOJ's surveillance of members of Congress, of journalists, and others. Yes, we also recently learned that the Trump DOJ had obtained similar secret subpoenas to obtain the records of reporters at the New York Times, Washington Post, and CNN, who, like Schiff and Swalwell, Donald Trump had regarded as his personal political enemies. And as with Apple, the media companies in these cases were also given gag orders by the feds not to inform the reporters in question that they were being surveilled. House Judiciary Committee Chair Jerry Nadler made the announcement of the formal investigation into the matter this week. He said, recent reports suggest that during the Trump administration, the Department of Justice used criminal investigations as a pretext to spy on President Trump's perceived political enemies. Nadler says in the statement, it remains possible that these cases, which now include members of Congress, members of press, President Trump's own White House counsel, are isolated incidents. Even if these reports are completely unrelated, they raise serious constitutional and separation of power concerns. Congress, he said, must make it extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible, for the department to spy on the Congress or the news media. We should make it hard for prosecutors to hide behind secret gag orders for years at a time. We cannot rely on the department alone to make these changes. He said it is also possible that these cases are merely our first glimpse into a coordinated effort by the Trump administration to target President Trump's political opposition. If so, we must learn the full extent of this gross abuse of power, root out the individuals responsible, and hold those individuals accountable for their actions. Like many Americans, he writes, I desperately want to see Attorney General Merrick Garland succeed in his goal of repairing the damage done by his predecessors and return a sense of normal to the Department of Justice. It is an important and worthy undertaking. It is not, however, something we can accomplish by simply turning the page on the Trump era. Citing Garland's announcement that the DOJ's inspector general would investigate the matter, Nadler said, I am encouraged by the steps the attorney general announced, but we cannot wait for the inspector general to share even his preliminary findings with DOJ some months or years from now before Congress contemplates a response. Accordingly, the House Judiciary Committee, he says, will investigate the Trump administration's surveillance of members of Congress, the news media, and others. I have instructed my staff to begin that work without delay, said Jerry Nadler. Well, that's good. Congress should investigate what happened here. But as longtime independent national security journalist Marcy Wheeler writes at her emptywheel.net website, some perspective may be in order here on the politicized leak investigations targeting Schiff, Swalwell, and members of their staff. Joining us now for that perspective is our old friend Marcy Wheeler, who, in addition to her prolific work at Empty Wheel, is also a contributor to other publications, including The Intercept, The Guardian, Politico, and The New York Times. Oh, Marcy Wheeler, welcome back to the broadcast.
Hey, really good to be back.
Glad to have you here. I know you were about to get, you thought you were getting your second Moderna jab today. I'm glad that didn't happen, because if what happened to me happens to you, you probably wouldn't be able to talk to me right around now. So I hope you're feeling okay. Now, Marcy, first, to be clear here, before we get into your article, I am infuriated. I'm appalled by what appears to have gone on here, what appears to be an outrageously politicized invasion of the rights to privacy for Democratic lawmakers to communicate with whoever they wish, and what appears to be a clear violation of the constitutional separation of powers between the supposedly co-equal executive and legislative branches of government. So before getting to your perspective on this matter, is it fair to share that outrage of this do you share my outrage, I guess, of this violation of rights and the hypocrisy of the separation of powers issue that the Trump administration was using to block any and all executive branch subpoenas that were coming from Congress?
Well, the hypocrisy is terrible and par for the course. But I actually don't think that this is unprecedented. And the most likely explanation for what the leak investigation was is that it was an investigation into who leaked that Carter Page had been targeted under FISA. And there was a parallel investigation that actually prosecuted the Senate Intelligence Committee staffer by the name of James Wolf. So no one balked at all when he was prosecuted in 2018. So it's clearly not unprecedented, because we can look, you know, across to the Senate and see what a similar prosecution, you know, how that was conducted. There are parts of this that are really problematic, and and I think we can unpack that.
You say it's not unprecedented, but the subpoenas you're talking about, those were not actual lawmakers, right? Those were staffers, aides, and so forth?
Right, but the thing about this was a stupid subpoena, and then the collection obtained by subpoena was politicized. So first, some dates. The subpoena was February 2018, so that was under Jeff Sessions.
Right.
But then an important part of the story is that in 2020, Bill Barr decided to kind of reopen the investigation, and from what he said, his denials of actually issuing the subpoena make it pretty clear that he was focusing on Schiff and Swalwell.
Mm-hmm.
So the really outrageous stuff came, as always, under Trump with Bill Barr.
Mm-hmm.
The earlier stuff was probably more stupid than scandalous.
Well, I don't know. The way you break it down, your article over the weekend at emptywheel.net, give some critical context here that I think, some perspective that I think people should actually understand. And, you know, no matter how angry some of the Democrats on the Intelligence Committee are, and on the Judiciary Committee now, there's clearly some lessons here that they maybe should learn moving forward, not just about what Donald Trump's DOJ did, but what really any DOJ can do if they want. So let's sort of step through your article here. First, you note, contrary to the way the Judiciary Committee described it in that press release that I shared, you say this is not spying. What do you mean by that?
Well, when Trump was trying to politicize the fact that Carter Page had been investigated after he left the Trump campaign, and trying to politicize that DOJ had used informants to investigate both a couple of people that were associated with Trump, but also Hillary Clinton's foundation. I mean, she was the principal, and they had biased biased FBI agents running informants against her foundation. None of those things are what we traditionally call spying, which is intelligence services without legal process spying on other people. All three of these things involve legal process.
So,
and especially in this case, it's a criminal investigation. It's not. It's not like the Carter Page thing. It was a counterintelligence investigation, so it's kind of squishier. But this was clearly a criminal investigation, and so back in 2017, 2018, at the time the subpoena was issued, Adam Schiff was saying, well, if there's legal process, it's not spying. He's got to hold himself to the same principle, which is if there was legal process, and there was legal process here, then it's not spying.
Is it fair to say that, do we know, did these subpoenas go through, they went through some legal process, did they actually go through a FISA court in order to obtain these subpoenas of Schiff and Swalwell?
No, they wouldn't need to, because it's just metadata. As far as we understand, and to be honest, part of the thing that has led to the outrage here is that the reporting on this has been really vague. And so it's not entirely clear what happened yet, but Apple, in their statement, has made it clear there was no content involved. And if you're not getting content, you don't need to get a warrant. And so what is understood to have happened, this was a grand jury subpoena. No warrant, no content, therefore, if it was a grand jury subpoena, no judge buying off on it. Now, in certain other circumstances, and probably with some of the investigation of HPSI, there was what's called a D order that would have involved a judge signing off on it. The judge would have had to sign off on the gag order, or the gag order would have been adjudicated. But in any case, point is that because this was not for content, there wouldn't be a warrant,
which
like there was with Carter Page.
Which brings us to one of your next points here, that this is quote-unquote just metadata. It's nothing to worry about. Adam Schiff has defended for years programs that obtained just metadata, meaning just records of who they were in contact with, not the actual content of the messages. Just metadata. Adam Schiff, Democrats have defended that for years. How revealing and or invasive is this just metadata that Adam Schiff is now experiencing?
Well, here's the other curious thing is sometimes when you get grand jury subpoenas, you ask for just subscriber information. And so what an investigator might do is say, here's 50 numbers that this suspect is calling. Mm-hmm. I want to know who he's calling. And then you go to the phone company or to Apple and say, who are these people? According to the reports, this grand jury subpoena involved more than that. So, for example, there was also a report that Don McGahn was subpoenaed, that his information was subpoenaed. In that case, it seems like it was just subscriber information. Tell me who this is. It was Don McGahn. Okay, thanks. Whereas in this case, it seems like they were asking for more, in part because the House sources for the story said that they got information from the inception of the account. And that tells you two things. One is it says that it's getting temporal data of some sort, and therefore possibly
temporal
recording.
Temporal data, you say?
Yeah, meaning it may describe who you've been texting over the last, how long have you had an Apple phone, right?
Uh-huh.
So it's or an Apple account. I can't even think how long that is, but that would suggest that it gets your texting. You know, it may have gotten their texting activity for that time period. And that's when the it's just metadata stories begin to fall apart, the ones that precisely Adam Schiff has been championing when he talks about surveilling Americans, and that is that when you get metadata for 10 years, right, that is enormously powerful and arguably powerful in a different way, but as powerful as content can be. And so if that's what happened, and there's reason to believe that is what happened, it means that the subpoena, I mean, the subpoena was stupid, as I said. But it also means the subpoena was not adequately targeted. And one of the things that it would be nice to come away from this conversation with is to say, great, now that you know how invasive metadata can be, can we put limits on the span of metadata that you can pull without without a judicial order? And that would be something, you know, maybe that Adam Schiff will have learned his lesson. Who knows? Right.
But, and that because
learned his lesson out of it.
Well, you point out that the subpoena was for records, we believe, going all the way back to 2009 in Adam Schiff's case. When they're looking at a leak investigation surrounding a leak about FISA material that happened in, 2016, if I have my dates right, why would they possibly
2017.
Why would they possibly ever need to go back to 2009 to get records on what happened on 2016 and 2017? Is that, did they do that just because, oh, that's basically how the law is written? When you go in to ask for these records, you just go get all of them at once? There's no narrow tailoring of the requests?
There's no requirement to tailor. So, for example, in the January 6th investigation, there's this guy named Antoine Broadnax, who's a musician, who just showed up to do a music video and ended up going in and getting involved in the riot. And in his case, Twitter and Facebook gave him notice that prosecutors were asking for his metadata. And same thing, they asked for the metadata going back to the time of creation, and he tried to challenge it. He was like, look, you know, this is about January 6th. Why are you getting metadata from the time I got on Twitter? He lost. That's the way the law is written. And I think he has as much of a complaint mm-hmm. as Adam Schiff does.
And I don't know if you actually answered this question. I know we've talked about it over the years, but just the idea, people who say, oh, it's just metadata. What sort of thing can we learn from that just metadata? And that's, you know, whether it goes back to 2009 in Adam Schiff's case. What's the danger of the potential danger, if you will, of having that information that lawmakers like Adam Schiff seem to have downplayed for so many years?
Well, you know, you could find out if somebody's having an affair. You could find out if somebody's in mental health treatment. You can find out if somebody's having an abortion. You can find out who their close associates with. I mean, like in Adam Schiff's case, mm-hmm. you know, do they have close political advisors that really is Adam Schiff's business knowing, mm-hmm. right? So long as the person isn't giving them financial stuff, there's not a need to tell who your political advisors are.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would give you some input there. It would give you some input how often he speaks to Nancy Pelosi, for example, or which members of Congress he speaks to and which he doesn't. And so on that level, it becomes problematic because it gives the executive branch a glimpse into what another branch of government is doing.
And this data, and you mentioned this a little bit earlier in our conversation, but this data, this now we know broad, wide-reaching data, potentially going all the way back to 2009 on someone who was considered to be a political enemy of Donald Trump's, well, the FBI got those records, they hang on to those records, and as you note, they never delete, apparently, those records, because is there nothing written into the law that if they obtain these records after a certain amount of time, if they are not, if they do not apply to this case, that they should be deleted? Instead, they just hang on to them forever?
Right. In some cases, and in the case of the journalists whose records were seized, those records will either be sealed or deleted.
Mm-hmm.
And there are circumstances where DOJ guidelines require you to do that, and they tend to be more tied to journalists than to politicians. But in general, for you and I, mm-hmm. well, you know, to the extent that we wouldn't be treated as journalists, mm-hmm. but if they were pulling them for some other reason, no, they would sit there in FBI coffers, and that's one of the complaints, right? So if Adam Schiff's data is, and this is what we think happened, we think that there were, you know, these records were seized in 2018,
mm-hmm.
and then in 2020, Bill Barr went back and used them. And it's not even clear whether Bill Barr was just looking at leak investigations. I mean, by that point, he was sort of doing a people who hate Donald Trump are, you know, treasonous investigations. And so the question is, how closely did he look at Schiff and Swalwell?
So in 2018, they obtain the records, they look at the records, they find that there is no evidence of what they're looking for, no evidence that Swalwell or Schiff were leaking classified material to media or whoever it is, whatever they were looking for. They didn't find it in 2018, but because they never delete it, then you get a new attorney general, Bill Barr, who comes in and says, hey, we have all of these records from these congressmen. Let's go back and give it another look. For what? For anything that Bill Barr may feel like looking at it for?
Right. And the other thing about this, so Swalwell and Schiff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is something most people don't understand. People, members of Congress on the intelligence committees do not have clearance. So the staffers have clearance, and therefore the executive branch has some control over them because
mm-hmm.
their clearance is basically owned by the executive branch.
Mm.
But I learned from Pete Hoekstra, who former Michigan congressperson who uh-huh. is Schiff's predecessor as uh-huh. the HPC chair, he never had clearance and didn't get clearance until he became ambassador to the Netherlands. And in that process, he also had no record of naturalization because he's an immigrant from the Netherlands. So so you could be a member of Congress and not necessarily have proven your American citizenship and still have access to this data because you're a separate branch of Congress. And one of the mm-hmm. reasons why we get leaks from the Gang of Four or from Congress is because really it's hard to prosecute an Adam Schiff because if he leaked information, he would not be violating his clearance because he doesn't have clearance. He might be thrown off the Intelligence Committee, and there have been examples of members being thrown off to the Intelligence Committee after they leaked classified information. But he doesn't have clearance.
Would he be committing a crime in leaking that information?
It's hard to prosecute a member of Congress for that. It's hard. And frankly, there have been instances, another reason I don't think it's entirely unprecedented to get records of staffers is because there was the Jeffrey Sterling investigation, which was prosecuted in 2015. The other leading suspect for that leak was a Senate Intelligence Committee staffer. Now, that staffer was protected. Mm-hmm. So when the FBI went to expand the investigation into that staffer, the committee said, no, you can't do it. And so that's the background, and that's the sort of expectation. And in fact, with James Wolfe, that other staffer on CISI that was prosecuted in 2018, the entire Senate had to vote to share his emails for that prosecution.
But
and so when you are going after staffers,
yeah,
even, you have to abide by these prerogatives. And it doesn't mean that you can't get the information. It means that you're going to have to convince Congress that this prosecution is worth pursuing.
Nonetheless, what we end up with here is, as far as I know, no evidence that Schiff or Swalwell or even so far, members of their staff, their aides or their children who were also subpoenaed, one of whom was a minor, that they did anything wrong, that they were the source of any leaks, as far as we know. And yet, Jerry Nadler is clearly hopping mad. Adam Schiff is, Eric Swalwell, Nancy Pelosi, a lot of folks are, and understandably so. But the fact is, it seems like everything that happened here was kind of annoying, but also rather legal and made legal by Congress themselves. I note that you write at one point, quote, "It's a pity for Adam Schiff that no one in charge of surveillance in Congress imposed better trackability requirements on FBI's access to its investigative collections." That was just one of the things that congressmen like Schiff could have done for years, but didn't. Instead, they were defending these programs. And now you got Jerry Nadler furious that, Congress was subpoenaed, members of media were subpoenaed. I share that fury. But there's a whole lot of Americans who are facing these very same things, and there is nobody in Congress, it seems, that is, outraged about it. In fact, they are defending it. Am I reading that correctly?
No. And the important thing, again, with just metadata, right, this just metadata that we keep talking about, the standard is there's no probable cause required. And so the standard is just relevant to. And so it may be, the FBI could have, they're not believed to have in this case, the FBI could have just said, we need all of the phone records for everybody on HPSI because they're the people who got the document that was leaked. And that meets the relevant to standard, and that is the standard that Adam Schiff has been telling us for years isn't all that intrusive. Now, one thing that's important to know about this, the reason they got to Adam Schiff and the reason they got to that kid is because what they had was a list of what are called selectors. Like, they had a list of phone numbers and emails.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have a list of Adam Schiff. They didn't have a list of names.
Okay.
And so what they were doing when they went to Apple was, tell us who these people are. And that's how they ended up, getting a kid's records and Adam Schiff's records.
Did Apple tell them?
Apple had no way.
Who these people are? Did Apple say, well, this is Congressman Adam Schiff, this is Congressman Eric Swalwell, and so forth?
Yeah, and at that point, that's when the process starts to go, hey, I mean, before that, up until that point, it's just stupid. After that point, you begin to get into scandal, because at that point, whoever got the record should have gone to their boss and their boss's boss and said, oh, geez, I just got Adam Schiff's phone record. We need to sequester them. We probably need to notify him, and that didn't happen. And so that's what allowed the records to sit there in the FBI coffers for 2 years for Bill Barr to come in and make mm-hmm. things worse.
Okay, let me add, I got just a minute or two here. I want to try to get in two quick questions. One, the DOJ is, when it comes to these gag orders you talk about where Apple is not allowed to tell their customers that they are being spied on, you note that when it comes to journalists, the DOJ is supposed to use shorter gag orders, just 3 months or so. But in this case, with Apple and the members of Congress and so forth, they used years-long gag orders, I guess a series of one-year-long gag orders. What, you know, to prevent Schiff and Swalwell and so forth from knowing about it, what do you glean from the fact that they used those longer gag orders to keep the congressman in the dark?
It was inappropriate, but it was sort of standard. What's one of the most interesting things about it, I mean, they were trying to keep the investigation secret, right? Mm-hmm. And so they assumed that if Adam Schiff were told that one of his staffers was being investigated, that Adam Schiff might tell the staffer. Now, mm-hmm. that's completely inconsistent. I mean, on the Senate side, what happened was when that guy became a focus, the FBI went to Mark Warner and Richard Burr and said, you know, this guy, we think he's compromised.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the only people on the committee who knew, but they were told, whereas in Schiff's case, he wasn't told. We don't know whether Devin Nunes was told, which is actually a really interesting question, because they may have said, well, we told Devin Nunes, so we ticked our box, right? which is crazy.
We told the Republican on the committee. We're just not telling the ranking Democrat. But what would be the purpose? They did it for a year, and then they extended it for another year. They're not finding any information on, you know, that these guys leaked. You're suggesting they're just putting these gag orders in place so this news story that we are now talking about over the past week doesn't come out for years on end. Is that really the only reason to issue such a gag order for that long?
No, I mean, I think that they didn't close the investigation. Here's the thing. They did eventually close the investigation.
Yeah.
That was last year.
Okay.
At that point, they should have notified everyone.
Right.
I mean, they you know, having already said they should have handled Schiff and Swalwell differently, at that point, when they close the investigation, they should then free up Apple to give notice. Now, it's possible that the gags were a year long, and you know, when they just let the gag expire, and then Apple came in and gave notice. Point being, though, that you know, it's not itself controversial to get gags to cover the length of an investigation, but there are, I think, real questions to ask why Schiff wasn't told last year when they closed the investigation, for example.
And what should be the lesson here ultimately for these lawmakers? And will they learn that lesson, or will they simply chalk it up to another case of bad behavior by the Trump administration? We don't need to worry about it anymore. He's gone. You know, now that it has affected them and journalists, you know, people that they know, you know, what should they learn? What should be the takeaway? What would you like to see changed in 30 seconds or less here, Marcy?
I think they need to do access limitations and breadth limitations on FBI so that what happens to Adam Schiff doesn't happen to, you know, this guy being investigated as part of the January 6th
mm-hmm.
Riot.
Right.
You know, it's the same thing. And maybe I think judges need to reconsider whether related to is really as unobtrusive as people think.
By the way, before I go, because we talked about this on a previous show with John Boniface of Free Speech for People, how confident are you right now at this moment? And you can change your mind in the days ahead, but how confident are you right now in Merrick Garland's ability to clean house at DOJ and at the very least help unearth all of this unseemly material, much less put reforms in place to prevent it from happening again?
I think we should expect a mixed record. I mean, on some things, I think he's going to be good, and on others, in particular, his support for Bill Barr's awful legal positions, he's not going to reverse DOJ, and it's going to infuriate all of us. But, you know, I say this. I did a piece the other day. The first thing that Lisa Monaco did, literally her first full day on the job, would sign the okay to raid Rudy Giuliani. And that investigation is going to be very, very damaging to Donald Trump.
And Lisa Monaco I'm sorry.
Is the Deputy Attorney General.
Right. And she came in and she okayed something that the previous department under Barr had essentially quashed, that investigation into Giuliani.
Correct.
Right.
And so that is a signal that they are not going to protect Trump from legitimate investigations. And there are a lot of legitimate investigations to go forward. So, you know, but the other thing people should know, for example, is that memo that DOJ is trying to defend, the keeping it secret, the Barr memo, mm-hmm. related to the Mueller report.
Yes.
The staffers that Amy Berman Jackson accused of being dishonest with her have been in those jobs for three administrations now. And yeah. I can tell you that the guy in OLC who made misrepresentations has been doing that since at least 2011, because I was complaining about it then.
So these aren't.
So it's not like
these aren't Trump appointee problems. These are endemic problems in the DOJ itself. It sounds like that.
Right. Some of this is about the executive branch being the executive branch, and we need to understand that, and we need to continue to push back on that, which is a bipartisan thing.
Thank you very much, Marcy Wheeler. Please continue to push back on everyone, as you always do, as you have for so many years, at emptywheel.net. Marcy Wheeler is, of course, a longtime independent national security journalist. You can also find her on the Twitters at emptywheel. Marcy, always great speaking with you. Good luck on your Moderna jab tomorrow.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, we have, yes, I know, Des, I have blown through our second break.
Yeah.
I have completely lost the ability to cover Joe Biden in his meeting with Vladimir Putin in Geneva today. But oh well, we had that good news at the top of the show about Joe Manchin and a potential path towards voting rights in the U.S. Senate. I think that was worth it. And of course, it's always worth it talking with Marcy Wheeler about anything.
Oh, indeed.
In my opinion. So sorry about that. We'll get it all straightened out tomorrow. Maybe we'll even play some Joe Biden tomorrow. We will see. That is on our next thrilling broadcast. Until then, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of this show or any other that we have ever done for all of time, you can download it at bradblog.com for free, all of which is made possible only by those of you who support our work by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. We rely 100% on your support to stay on your public airwaves. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, you'll find me at The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.